Let's draw our attention back to Leviticus, the rule book for Levites. Chapter number 24 is where we want to pick up today. We're looking at a lot of variant rules and regulations and comments about things going on during the year. And in chapter 24, we come back to things that have to be maintained inside the holy place of the tabernacle. That is the place where the priests do their daily duty. And so this is what God provides for Moses. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, command the people of Israel to bring you pure oil from beaten olives for the lamp, that a light may be kept burning regularly. So this is for the menorah, the seven-branched lampstand made of gold. It has the form of a stylized almond tree in bloom, and it provides the light inside the holy place. And I've talked about the idea that the seven branches are a reference to the 7 days of the week, and that effectively the light of God's Word, the light of God's Holy Spirit guidance is being presented here in this form. And it needs fuel. It has to have a fairly high-grade olive oil. Verse number 3, outside the veil of the testimony, that's a reference to the veil between the holy place where the priests do their daily work and the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant, God's portable throne, is located. Outside the veil of the testimony in the tent of meeting, Aaron shall arrange it from evening to morning before he who is regularly. And we talked about how when he comes in to do the morning sacrifice, that is the morning incense offering, while the morning sacrifice is being offered outside on the great altar, he will also trim the lamps, the seven lamps, meaning he will probably pull out the burned wick, replace it with a brand new one. He'll fill it up or top off each of the lamps with the high-grade olive oil and make sure that the light is transferred to this new wick. And so the light will always be shining here in the tabernacle. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations. He shall arrange the lamps on the lampstand of pure gold before he who is regularly. So we need the light of God, like the psalmist says. Your word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path, right? That idea. Then across the way from the menorah, the menorah is on the south side of the tabernacle building. On the north side is the table of the bread of God's presence, which is another representation of daily interaction with God. And this is the instruction. You shall take fine flour and bake 12 loaves from it. Now, the 12 is not that hard to figure out just on our own. It's the 12 tribes of Israel. They are being represented as being in God's presence day by day. Now, how big are these loaves? Well, they're 2/10 of an ephah, shall be in each loaf. An ephah is less than a, it's several 2-liter pop bottles worth of flour, if you want to look at it that way. You shall set them into piles, 6 in a pile. Now, this is the place where we find out that they are stacked in 2 stacks. Now, the bread, don't think of a loaf of bread like we have in our modern Western society. These are like giant pitas, as you still see in the Middle East. And so there's six of them in each stack. They're on the table of pure gold before he who is, and you shall put pure frankincense on each pile. Now, it doesn't say how much. Maybe it's just a little sprinkle. That it may go with the bread as a memorial portion, as a food offering to he who is. We've got this frankincense representing prayer. So the people are represented by the bread, and the incense represents the prayers of those people. Every Sabbath day, now I really love this part, Aaron shall arrange it before he who is regularly. It is from the people of Israel as a covenant forever. And it shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, since it is for him a most holy portion out of he who is his food offerings, a perpetual due. Now later, in the regulations regarding the temple, we have a better understanding of this ceremony that would take place every week. In that case, of the temple that was designed by David with Holy Spirit influence, it was understood that there were courses of priests. Not all the priests could serve at the exact same time. So they were divided up, 24 courses, and each course would serve 1 week. Now, of course, they can't travel on a Sabbath day. That's a rest day. So that means that the course that's coming on duty has to have arrived on the sixth day of the week before the Sabbath begins. And the course that's going off duty can't leave until the first day of the week after the Sabbath is over. So that means every Sabbath in the temple, and we can say the same thing for the tabernacle during its period of existence, you would have multiple priests on duty at the same time, overlapping. And the bread of the presence is to be swapped out, I think, at the end of each Sabbath, which means on Saturday night, right before the sun goes down. And then once the first day of the week begins, after the sun has gone down on Saturday night, then new bread is going to be baked and put in its place, probably in some sort of special ceremony. And what would happen is that all the priests involved in these special ceremonies would eat the bread together, the special bread that has been there for a week in God's presence. Now, my guess is, and that's all it is that there were also probably 12 cups of wine that sat on this temple or on this tabernacle table all week, and more than likely, that wine was swapped out for new wine on the first day of the week, and probably the priests used that to wash down the bread. So that I picture it that every week, as the Sabbath turned into the first day of the week, the priests would gather around the table of the Lord, and they would break bread and drink of the wine. Now, that sounds so much like the practice of weekly communion to me. And I love it, love it, love it. And so I hope it finds something in your heart as well. One last thing about this special bread before we move on. This is the bread that David was given for himself and for his loyal soldiers when he fled from Saul, murderous King Saul, that last time. The high priest that David ran to gave him the sword of Goliath, which was being kept as a donated gift to the Lord there in the tabernacle. But David also requested supplies, and the priest said, but it's a Sabbath day. All we have is the bread of the presence that's being swapped out. And the high priest made the personal call that as long as David and his men had been abstaining from sexual contact with their wives, then they could eat of this special bread. Now, he was wrong. The rules are very clear in Leviticus that only priests who were ceremonially clean could eat of the bread of the presence in this change over to the new week ceremony. But Jesus uses that example to combat the foolishness of the Pharisees who gave David a pass on that because, after all, he was a hero to them. But they wouldn't give a pass to people who did things on the Sabbath that the Pharisees didn't like. They wanted those people prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. So this is the special bread that is referenced in that New Testament story. Let's move on. Verse number 10. Now, an Israelite woman's son, whose father was an Egyptian. So here we have a young man of indeterminate age who is half Israeli, half Egyptian. But he's living in the community of Israel, which means he should be living by the rules. This half Israeli, half Egyptian went out among the people of Israel, and the Israelite woman's son and a man of Israel fought in the camp. We don't know what the argument was about. We don't know what the fight was over with. But we do know this. And the Israelite woman's son blasphemed the name and cursed. So he spoke about Yahweh in a disrespectful fashion. Said something obscene or rude or rebellious about the king of the encampment. So the witnesses who heard him say all this nasty stuff, they brought him to Moses. His mother's name was Shelomit, the daughter of Dibri, of the tribe of Dan. That, of course, is going to be in the record of this judicial action. That's why it's here in the book of Leviticus. They put him in custody till the will of he who is should be clear to them, because there have been places besides the Ten Commandments that say you shall not use the name of he who is your God in vain. But there was nothing up to this point, apparently, describing what the penalty for doing so was. So he who is spoke to Moses, saying, bring out of the camp the one who cursed, and let all who heard him lay their hands on his head. These are the witnesses. And let all the congregation stone him. So here, blasphemy takes on a capital crime. It becomes a capital crime. Now, I think we should make it clear again that there would have been an investigation asking these witnesses, did it just fall out of his mouth? Was it just an accident? What was the deal? What was the context of this happening? And it would have become very clear in the testimony that this man has no respect for he who is. And that's why he said the things that he said. And so that makes him a rebel, a traitor to the king. And so that is why it is a capital crime. Speak to the people of Israel, saying, whoever curses his God, shall bear his sin. Meaning that there will be consequences. Whoever blasphemes the name of he who is shall surely be put to death. And so all the congregation shall stone him. The sojourner, so that's the temporary resident of the land of Israel, because this will be applied to the land of Israel eventually, as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, he shall be put to death. So that was God's response. And then we have a repeat of some other laws that we've already gone over regarding the execution of justice, not always death, whenever people have committed crimes. Verse 17, whoever takes a human life shall surely be put to death. Now, we know from other passages, it is intentional murder that is capital crime. Accidental death, different story. Whoever takes an animal's life shall make it good, life for life. So if you end up killing your neighbor's animal, then you owe your neighbor an equivalent animal. If anyone injures his neighbor as he has done it, it shall be done to him. Now, this is very important to understand. This that we're about to read, lex talionis, I think that's the term a lot of people know it by, eye for an eye. This is the rule of the court. This is not individual response. So in other words, God is telling the court what they should do in dealing with criminal behavior. He's not telling people what to do when you've been injured. You don't get to take vengeance. The difference between vengeance and justice is that justice is carried out by a third party after carefully weighing things judicially. Okay? So if you injure your neighbor, then you're going to have the same thing done to you that you did to them. For example, fracture for fracture. You break your neighbor's arm, then apparently if the judges decide that you did it on purpose or you did it because you weren't paying due care to another person, then they can cause an executioner. Now, remember, use that in the sense of somebody that carries out a task. Then they can cause an executioner to break your arm at exactly the same spot. Now, what's the point? The point is that maybe you'll think before you do anything to anybody else because you don't want to have the same thing done to you. Seems like we have a New Testament principle that is the more positive equivalent to that. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Right? That's the idea. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Whatever injury he has given a person shall be given to him. And again, I stress, it is the court system that carries this penalty out after consideration of all the facts. Verse 21, whoever kills an animal shall make it good. Whoever kills a person shall be put to death. Now, we just saw that. So when we see repeated material, it means that's important stuff. You shall have the same rule for the sojourner and for the native, for I am he who is your God. So temporary residents need to know the rules because the rules apply to them, just like they apply to the locals. Verse 23, so Moses spoke to the people of Israel, and they brought out of the camp the one who had cursed and stoned him with stones. And thus the people of Israel did as he who is commanded Moses. And so this apparently the first execution for blasphemy in Israel's independent history. Chapter number 25, we move on to some more calendar-related issues. He who is spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you." So a reminder that this is to be started once you arrive in country. "The land shall keep a Sabbath to he who is." So the people are keeping a weekly Sabbath. The land needs to also have a Sabbath. Now, of course, it's going to get a Sabbath every week because the people are not working it, but this takes it one step farther. Verse 3 of 25. "For 6 years you shall sow your field, and for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruits, but in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to he who is. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard." So this is what we refer to from here on out as the sabbatical year. The Israelis, when they arrive in the country, they will plant for the very first time in the fall after they've arrived. And that will start their first year of work. And they will do 6 of those in a row. When the 7th year comes around, they're not going to go out and work the ground and plant anything. They're just going to let the earth rest on its own. More, verse number 5. "You shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for he who is." So this is the second part of this. Not only are they not going to go out and plow and till and plant or even water, they are not going to harvest in the traditional sense, meaning they're not going to go out there with their sickles and their scythes and cut down the majority of their grain and process it and store it away. That is not allowed during the sabbatical year that runs from the fall until the beginning of the next fall, pretty much. They're not going to gather the grapes like they would normally do, like pick a peak day of harvest, go out there and cut all those clusters that are ripe off. No, they're not allowed to do that. Same thing with the olive trees. They don't whack the branches on a peak day. They let those things alone. Now, in a bit, we'll find out who gets to utilize all of that grain that pops up on its own, because volunteer grain always pops up. And we know that those undressed vines are still going to produce clusters of grapes in plenty. Same thing with the olive trees, apple trees, or whatever type of tree and plant. Who's going to use that? We'll get to that. Verse number 6. "The Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourself, and for your male and female slaves, and for your hired worker, and the sojourner who lives with you, and for your cattle, and for the wild animals that are in your land. All its yield shall be for food." Okay, now we can talk a little bit about that volunteer crop. While you can't have an organized harvest, you can go out and gather what is needed each day for your use. So if you want to have a nice bit of bread for your meal, you can go out and cut just enough grain out of any field. It doesn't have to be your field. More than likely it will be, but any field, because all these fields belong to God. You can cut just enough grain to process your flour for that day's bread. And if you want some olives, you can go out and pick just what you imagine you're going to eat. Same thing with the dates. Same thing with the vines, the grape clusters. Only what you're going to use. That's it. No more. And so everybody's going to be able to do that. The poor people are going to definitely be able to gather all that. We'll get back to that later. And you can also feed your animals off this, or they can feed it themselves if you turn them loose out there. So this is the sabbatical cycle. Every 7 years, nobody works to bring in a harvest. Now that's interesting, because when you read the history of the Jewish people, you find out that taxes were not collected in the sabbatical year. When the Jewish people were under Greek leadership, such as Alexander the Great, they petitioned for not having to pay taxes in their sabbatical year, and he granted it. When the Jewish people later came under Roman law, they petitioned the government, and the government made the rule that the Jewish people never had to pay their taxes in the sabbatical year because they had no income in that year. And so this is something that was practiced at least in part throughout Israel's history. The next item, which we'll come back to next time we're in the Word, is something we're not altogether certain how often it was practiced.